A year ago, all eyes were turned to D.C. Members of Congress gathered in their Capitol chambers to formally certify the 2020 election results. And a couple of miles away, then-President Donald Trump held a rally decrying his election loss.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing.
But as the day went on, a contingent of pro-Trump protesters began to form a crowd outside the Capitol building.
We need to march on the Capitol when we're done here and drag these people out of power.
And then the chaos began.
Capital entry.
Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee was inside House chambers as the entire building went on lockdown, and the Capitol Police barricaded the doors.
Take your pins off.
Pins off.
I'm not afraid to admit it. I know I was afraid. I was scared. I didn't know what was going to happen. None of us knew. We could hear gunfire. There was, as it turns out, a person shot and killed right in our proximity at that very time.
Everybody stay down! Get down!
Protesters had forced their way past barricades and police officers to rush the building.
There were people who stormed the Senate chambers who had zip ties on and were carrying weapons. I mean, you do that to take hostages.
Members of the House and Senate, including West Michigan Republican Congressman Peter Meyer, were ushered into tunnels to escape.
There were times when we would find ourselves in a tunnel or in some part of the Capitol complex. It was 30 or 40 of us and look around and realize we had no law enforcement there with us. I don't know what would have happened in that scenario if one of those people was zip-tied in a weapon, if we would have encountered them then. I don't know what would have happened.
Many of us were glued to our screens for hours on January 6th as the insurrection unfolded. And in the days and weeks and months after, many of us grappled to make sense of what had happened and what it meant for democracy. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The game changed for a lot of people on January 6th, 2021. Maybe for no one more than Peter Meyer. The freshman congressman represents Michigan's 3rd district, currently including Grand Rapids and Battle Creek. He's part of the family whose name is on grocery stores all over Michigan. And he's an Army veteran and a Republican. As the successor to Justin Amash, the libertarian star, Peter Meyer was never really as closely identified with Donald Trump as some House members. But when he was one of a handful of Republicans who voted to impeach the former president for what he did after January 6th, Meyer found himself with a political target on his back. Writer Tim Alberta profiled Peter Meyer in an extensive article that appeared in The Atlantic. Alberta says that when Peter Meyer first ran for office, he was not naive about the bitterly divided state of American politics.
And yet, he's also really of the belief that America has been through tough times before and that, you know, we get through these tough times and that sort of the foundations of this country institutionally are strong. And he is, despite all of the doom and gloom around him entering office, he's still fundamentally optimistic and really believes that he's coming to Washington to help solve some of these big problems and help get the country back on track. And so he's optimistic. He's idealistic. You could even sort of call him a political romantic of sorts. And he cops to that. And so that was sort of his mentality heading into office. But then, as you said, just in his third day on the job, I mean, he's literally trying to find the bathroom in the Capitol when it's invaded and overrun. And suddenly his view of the place and his view of America, quite frankly, begins to change.
Yeah. The first part of the story is the worst 96 hours of Peter Meyer's life, as he would put it. He's preparing to vote on impeachment for President Trump. He talks to a prominent business leader who remains nameless, who goes, quote, full QAnon conspiracy and indicates that he believes the election was stolen. I think there were parts of this story that may have been a bit of a surprise to West Michigan Republicans who pride themselves as being the thinking person's conservative party. Peter Meyer, Fred Upton, Justin Amash all found their place in this part of the state. But a lot of this seems to fly in the face of that.
Very much so. And in April, I think it's worth noting that, you know, Peter Meyer, in many ways, as harrowing as his story is, you know, he'd be the first to tell you that he doesn't have it as bad as some of his colleagues do. Because, yes, on the one hand, you could look at some of the details in this story and listen to some of his experiences and anecdotes and realize that even in a place like West Michigan, where the partisan discourse is relatively tame, that he's, you know, experienced a lot of, you know, really, really sort of menacing rhetoric and has come to see that the political fringe is far more active, even in a place like Grand Rapids, than he thought. And yet it is still Grand Rapids. It is still West Michigan. And compared to some of the districts represented by some of his colleagues around the country, it's actually not nearly as put it this way. If there were people in West Michigan who were treating Peter Meyer the way that they've treated some of his colleagues, I think there's a very good chance that he might have just decided already to walk away, because for as nasty and vitriolic as things got in the immediate aftermath of January 6th and in the immediate aftermath of the impeachment vote a week later, things did begin to sort of calm down later in the year for Peter Meyer, and things sort of, the temperature came down a bit in West Michigan. That has not been the case everywhere else. And in fact, it has led to the retirement of several of his Republican colleagues.
Right. At the same time that this is happening to him personally, he's receiving an encrypted note that you write about from a White House staffer, also remaining nameless, who encouraged impeachment of the president. I mean, here is someone from his own party saying, yes, you should vote to impeach. I guess it's just indicative of how very much the political math changed during the past 2 years.
Oh, yes. And it's not, on the one hand, it's not surprising, given if you jump in the DeLorean time machine and go back to January 6th and relive some of the trauma and the carnage of that day, frankly, it's not surprising that some people close to the president who were a witness to his action more accurately, his inaction. It's not surprising that some of them would believe that impeachment was warranted and would even be discussing a possible use of the 25th Amendment to remove him from office altogether. On the other hand, even though we say it's not surprising given the context of the times, given the sort of context of the office and the sweep of the American presidency, it's absolutely astonishing to think that one of the president's deputies, somebody close to him, would be, on the day of the impeachment vote, texting on an encrypted app with a freshman member of Congress from the president's party saying, yes, please do this. We need him gone. I don't think we can ever let the urgency and the extraordinary nature of that sort of exchange escape us, even as the time passes and even as we gain more distance from January.
We'll be back in just a minute with more from political reporter Tim Alberta. Stay put.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Support for the Stateside podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
Can I ask you to read a section from the story with us?
Sure.
Do you want to set this up a bit?
Really, prior to the invasion of the Capitol and the impeachment of Donald Trump, Meyer really thought that his job in Washington was going to be, you know, working on accountability for military deployments and increasing economic competitiveness with China and working on policy and being a wonk and all that sort of thing. And then January 6th happens, and then he votes a week later to impeach Trump. And he really sort of comes to a realization that his mission in Washington is to help save the Republican Party from itself, that basically he's in for a penny, he's in for a pound. Meyer realizes that there's no going back on it and that he needs to help lead this mission to really force this reckoning on the Republican Party to atone for all of the extremism that led to January 6th and to try and purge Trumpism from the Republican Party.
So we could say that this passage is all about the rewiring of Peter Meyer's brain after he gets elected.
Exactly. I think that's a good way to think of it. Yeah. The criticism back home was unceasing. The only praise he received was whispered. National polls showed that tens of millions of Republican voters still believed the election had been stolen. Looking around, Meyer saw that he was a leader without any following and realized how Pollyannish he'd been. Quote, "It's like, all right, this is going to be a longer, deeper project than I thought," unquote, he told me. Meyer's sense of urgency gradually gave way to self-doubt. He began to wonder whether his appeals to decency and democracy came across as pearl-clutching. He could tell he was rubbing some of his constituents the wrong way. They could stomach a disagreement with their congressman. What they couldn't tolerate was the lecturing and the finger-wagging. He sensed that he might be doing more harm than good with his high-minded rhetoric. Quote, "I've come to realize the limitations of performative outrage," unquote, he told me. So he backed off. He took voters' earfuls in stride. He says he decided that, quote, "by actively trying to correct them, I may have been inadvertently postponing the self-correction," unquote, "that would come with some distance from Trump's presidency."
Having spent all this time with him and having talked to him about this revelation that he had to go through, forced revelation, how do you think Peter Meyer feels about his party today?
You know, I don't want to be too cute with it, April. I really don't, because I do think that Peter Meyer is in a very dark place with his party. He doesn't know where any of this is going. And at least in the short term, all indications are that it's going to get worse before it gets any better. He concedes that Donald Trump, if he runs again, is almost certain to win his party's nomination and could very well win the presidency again. Moreover, he looks around and sees that the former president and his loyalists are at the state and county and local level installing their loyalists in key positions all around the country, canvassing boards, election boards, state legislatures. This is a clear and overt attempt to succeed in 2024 where they failed in 2020 as far as attempting to overturn the result of a legitimate Democratic election. So all of this is happening right under Peter Meyer's nose, and he can see it. And it obviously makes him sort of despairing for the future of the Republican Party. And yet I do think that there is a piece of him that holds out hope that as ugly and you know, quite frankly, as terrifying as all of this is, that history shows politics to be cyclical, that these movements rise and fall, and that if some of the folks who are like-minded can band together and even in a vocal minority can help to push back on this and can wait it out a bit and stick around long enough for reinforcements to arrive, then there is hope that there can be sort of a, you know, a longer term reckoning, certainly not the immediate clash with reality that he was hoping to force upon the party, but that there could be some years down the line, perhaps, a reclamation of the Republican Party as he once knew it.
this what you're talking about with Trump supporters and activists getting like-minded folks in county-level clerical and election positions. It strikes me that Peter Meyer came into the political process without some of the relationships that a traditional rise in the party has to involve. Is that what we're seeing here? Just that because he came in on his own steam, bankrolled his own campaign, that he may not have the kind of clout to stop what's happening?
You know, that's a really interesting observation, April, and I think there's probably some truth to it, no doubt. You know, our politics have been dramatically inverted in this country in recent years. There was, of course, in the 80s, the famous Tip O'Neill observation that all politics are local. But in many ways today, all politics are national. And what I mean by that is when you have a movement, the likes of, you know, the one Donald Trump has created that has grown so powerful and has really sort of captured the American right. That is, I think, in many ways, sort of neutralizing whatever clout or whatever cachet any congressman may have in their district, even a longtime veteran congressman like Fred Upton, who we mentioned earlier, been in office for many years, has done a lot of work for constituents around the state of Michigan. Even Fred Upton is, you know, being censured by his local Republican Party. Even Fred Upton is being threatened by primary challengers and has seen his sort of political capital almost entirely diminished with his Republican base back home because of his vote to impeach President Trump. And so all of that to say, I do think that, yes, you're absolutely right. Meyer is sort of playing a weaker hand than a typical congressman, typical local official might be. But I don't know that in this environment, anybody who crosses former President Trump is going to have much leverage with their local Republican base. We've seen that time and again over the last 5 years.
If I can just ask you one more question about the activism that is attempting to sort of change the character of elections and how they're run. As we mentioned, there are Republicans who supported President Trump trying to position themselves to be able to decline to certify election results in contests in the future. You spent a lot of time covering national politics and going to places where important elections were being held. Do you think that county and state level Republican Party groups who do favor Trump have the power to change election results in the next few contests?
I absolutely do. And I think it is every bit the clear and present danger to American democracy that one might assume it is. And I think if we saw it happening in any other country, we would know precisely what to call it and what to think about it. But because it's happening here, we are sort of mystified by it and want to believe that it's not happening and that it's not a real threat, but it is. We saw in Michigan just, you know, 12 months ago, what it looks like when you have local elections officials and, you know, local canvassing officials, folks who hold ministerial positions, who are essentially in place to kind of supervise and review and then rubber stamp election results. We saw what happens when some of those people decide to go rogue for partisan purposes. And it can be so easy to forget, April, just how close we came to a real constitutional crisis in the aftermath of the 2020 election. And I feel like every day that we remove ourselves from the fall of 2020 and the early weeks of 2021, the further we get removed from it, I think the sting sort of recedes. And we want to believe, all of us, myself included, that we're safer than we are, that we're more insulated than we are. But the simple fact is that you are seeing all across the country the popular movement that carried Trump into office and that nearly carried him to a second term, it has translated almost all of its energies, organizational energies, into reshaping these local and state elections processes in a way that if Trump were to lose another election legitimately, they would have the power and the mechanical capacity to overturn that result. That's exactly what's happening right now, and it is a very real and live possibility.
Tim Alberta, staff writer for The Atlantic. Tim, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And that's the Stateside Podcast for today. I'm April Baer. You can find more Stateside to listen to at michiganradio.org. Today's pod episode was produced by April Van Buren and by our executive producer, Laura Weber Davis. Other producers on our show are Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Claire Morishima. Our theme music is by 14KT, additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Williams.
I'm Lester Graham. We've been working on a big project about Great Lakes birds called The Bird Connection.
It will look at ducks and trumpeter swans,
egrets and herons,
and piping plovers. Yes!
We'll discuss what we've discovered at a Michigan Public Issues and Ale event,
including how some problems for birds are problems for people.
It's at Arbor Brewing Company in Ypsilanti, the evening of May 21st at 7.
You can register at michiganpublic.org.